Hey, everybody, time for another Shop Talk show. This is 233. Join Dave and I as we, go down some intentional rabbit holes this week, I would say. We go down one about an article about intentionally not using preprocessors with a little bit of a twist, which I think is interesting and kind of a sign of the times at the moment. We talk a little bit about those weird 8-digit hex codes, which is kind of interesting. We talk about how you mark up an email address so it's kind of not annoying and what are the best practices for that these days. We talk a little bit about Webpack and Gulp and stuff and how those things compare to each other. And one of the rabbit holes we go down is, you know, those kind of like annoying, possibly irrelevant, maybe tests that you might be forced to take as you would apply for a job. Do those things really matter? Are they ridiculous? How many gumballs are in a bus? I don't know. I should mention that this show of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by the most amazing web platform coding machine thing out there, CodePen. You all know it. Hopefully you all love it. We have pro plans at CodePen that do things like allow you to bring CodePen onto other websites. By that, I mean embeds. You know, you can take up any pen on CodePen, get embed code for it, which is kind of like a miniature version of the CodePen editor. That's free for everybody. But if you want to like have it then also be editable so you can be like writing HTML and CSS and seeing the results of it update immediately in real time on your own blog or documentation site for your library or whatever, those editable embeds are a pro feature, just one of many pro features available to you at codepen.io/pro. Check it out. But for now, let's kick things off, Mr. Dave.
Hey there, Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. Today's a rapid fire. I'm Dave Rubit. With me is Chris Bulletman Coyer. That's what I call you.
Lots of bullet points. Oh. This is just going to be a classic rapid fire episode where we answer as many questions as we can and fully intend to be derailed by a couple of them and go off into tangents, including this very first one. By a Mr. Dan Mindrew from Denmark, it looks like. A little bit of background on Dan says he's a front-end developer and experienced designer at his own startup for the last 3 years. Congratulations, Dan. That sounds pretty sweet. Recently decided to maybe get a little additional side work and tried to join a, he says, rather exclusive freelancing network platform called, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly, Toptal, T-O-P-T-A-L. They're kind of a little awkward of a thing to say, but it says, you know, I went to their website. It says, hire the top 3% of freelance talent. Looks like they've got a lot of good press and stuff. I think you sign up for it as a freelancer and they throw work your way when they got it, or if people are looking to hire freelancers, they come there. So they're trying to be a middleman for freelancers, and they're trying to be a middleman for really good ones, apparently. Which, of course, why would you be a middleman for bad freelancers? That would be weird. So he says, while signing up for it, the second phase of the application was a so-called coding challenge where I was given three tasks in 30 minutes to solve each task. It didn't go so well, to say the least. In fact, I'm not embarrassed to say I got 0%, not 5%. Not 10%, 0%. So here goes. My imposter syndrome hits me like it never did before. I'm not going to go into the challenge details, but in short, all three challenges were about building some abstract algorithms. For example, the second task was about manipulating some numbers in base negative 2. Hmm. I never claimed to be great at doing algorithms, but I do have a deep understanding of the basic concepts. My degree is in web development. It was not focused on hardcore coding, but I did learn about object-oriented programming, MVC, functional programming, coding in a variety of languages. So he's a front-end developer, Do they need to be amazing at building abstract algorithms? I mean, it sounds like he's just like not even invited to Toptal because he couldn't solve these things. So this is a quagmire, I think. This is, there's a lot to talk about here. So what strikes you right away from all this, Dave? Do you have an initial thought?
Man, I'm going to use a swear. We got to, the industry has to get their shit together about this. Because...
We've talked about it before, like maybe there should be some, like would the industry be better off if there was some kind of standardized testing, like the bar, for example.
That would be very welcome, because then you have like a goal. You're not just like walking into a room and it's like, well, okay, solve these math problems in base two because you're working with CSS, you know, like that makes no sense. I have a friend applied for a job at a like name brand company, and they have a very bad website, very like ugly website. I use it kind of frequently, and they like sat him down or sent him off with some homework and was like, okay, go write a whole REST API and document it and do like a full REST documentation block or doc or so, API doc, I think it was what it's called. And it's just like, never heard of it. I'm like, whatever, 20 years into making websites, 25, and I've never, like, no one's ever asked me to make an API doc. And I'm just like, what an arbitrary thing that your company thinks is very important that no one else thinks is important. And like, does that get you any closer to better HTML, CSS, and JavaScript for a front-end person? I mean, if...
Yeah, that I think, so there's a thing to unpack a little bit is the fact that you're at, sometimes when you're applying for a front end position, you in the job really is going to be writing a good HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, that the questions that they ask you aren't those type of questions. They're asking like really weird computer science questions for a job that in the end doesn't require all that much computer science. So there's definitely some like problems there that I can get my head around. It reminds me of the Laura Shank mm-hmm. story that happened on CSS Tricks where she had some real trouble doing FizzBuzz live in front of somebody because it was the first time she's ever heard of that problem. She's like, what is this weird algorithmic thing? And didn't do well on it, couldn't solve it despite attempting to talk her way through it, and then didn't get the job. And then wrote about that experience on CSS Tricks, and it didn't go well for her or for that article on CSS because it hit Reddit or whatever and all these type of things. And basically are there like, you know, calling her the worst names imaginable and just being really kind of rude about the situation. And that guy, if you can't solve this, how can you possibly call yourself a programmer kind of thing, which I thought was silly. And her analysis of the situation is the same as Dan's here, and then it's a little silly. Like, she's proven that she's pretty good at doing a certain type of work, front-end-ish work, and in her case, a lot of WordPress work and stuff like that. She's very effective at it. I've seen her teach other people it. I know for a fact that she's pretty good at this kind of work, and it's weird to see her, like, lose a job where the description of the job is the type of things I know her to be good at, but didn't get it because she couldn't solve FizzBuzz. So that's, you know, that's part of the quagmire. And then the other part of the quagmire is, are the things that they're asking you to do, do they actually want the correct answer, or is it that they actually want you to hear you talk your way through it, that it's actually not about the right answer, but it's about learning about you and not so much the correct answer, in which case who cares what the questions are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this, it's such, I think like the Laura story is a great example. I mean, like, if I'm writing CSS, how does FizzBuzz even impact my life? But I could see if you're looping through WordPress templates, that could be very like applicable. Or if you're doing some JavaScript, that could be very applicable. I think like there are reasons, like some tests are valid for the kind of things your company does or you know, but these kind of it always comes down, right? It's always these like computer science gotchas, you know, these sort of, okay, here's like some CSS 101 or CS 101 sort of stuff. Did you learn it? Are you in the group or are you out of the group? Because we're only hiring people in the group. I just, it's really like, It just blows my mind that, like, it seems like these companies don't even know who they're hiring for. And like, I can go read a book. And in fact, I'm thinking about buying a book to teach me all this stuff I don't know. I wish I could remember the name of the book. I'll try to find it here. But,
oh, I saw that. Maybe we saw the same thing, that like things that you missed out on if you didn't get a computer science degree.
Yeah. Was it like the Imposter Handbook? Or?
Yeah, I think
I'm going to look for it.
That would be is the perfect idea for a book, because I think that's really clever as well, to teach you the computer science stuff that a lot of us self-taught people didn't get. But I wonder, you know, back to your friend who was asked to write API, were they asking him to write a REST API, and were they asking him to write API docs, or were they asking him write some words that are intended for the public to read? And because we want to see if you can handle that, we want to get a sense for, you know, your sense of, can you write clearly? Can you write about technical subjects clearly? And that's what it was actually about. And
yeah, you know, possibly. I mean, but, or is it just about like, do you know the 7 HTTP verbs, and do you know how to use them and map them to correct URLs for the React app we're building or something? It's like, I see the organizational value, but like, that does not fix your website. Like, your website has problems already, like lots of problems. Why? That's not what, like, the questions you're asking doesn't fix that. It's just some technical hoop that you're trying to get people to jump through. So I don't know. I feel like I've been reading.
I'm not trying to defend it. No. I'm just trying to present both sides of this a little bit. Cause it's kind of like, there's the Google one too. Like, oh, how many gumballs can fit into a school bus kind of thing. But that's a little more less veiled, cause it's clear that they want you to, like, they want to hear you think about that problem, not so much guess the amount of gumballs correctly. Mm. So I think maybe being a little bit more abstract in that is useful. And people make fun of Google for asking about algorithms and stuff like that, or not even make fun of it, but say, oh, what a silly, weird way to interview people that can't possibly be getting at the heart of how good that people is. Yet, does it look like there's a bunch of dumb people at Google?
No, it doesn't.
You know, so it's kind of like, maybe these things work sometimes. And then here's another one. Say your top tell. Are they evil bastards because they do these challenges and we don't think that they're the correct challenges? Maybe not. They're in a position where they're trying to be this middleman for freelancers at scale. They need to evaluate lots of people in a way that's going to work for the startup-ish thing that they're trying to build. I have no idea how big TopTal is. I've never used them. It's the first time I've heard of
it. It's the top.
Maybe they're huge and they've solved. That's the top. The top total. Like, so I don't know. If they're successful at doing this, then fine, kind of. Like what's a better solution for them?
Well, and the reason you probably got zero is because they're trying to slice a very thin piece of the pie. I mean, if you like take a bell curve or something, they want the tiny bit at the end, like 2 standard deviations away. Like they want the like little piece at the end of the talent pool. And whether they're getting it or not, I don't know, but they probably have engineered a kind of very esoteric, which means like insider knowledge sort of thing, but they've developed an esoteric test to that they feel gets them that top. Like
you got to feel like if you've signed up and you've taken these tests, they're not, and you've done not so well on them, they're not exactly throwing that email address away. That's not how companies operate. They're probably selling you downstream to some other thing. You know, they're not going to, just because you're not in the top 3, they're not going to be like, well, you're gone. No, screw that.
No. And so, yeah, they're going after, I think their strategies go after a very thin kind of piece of the pie. So that they can like.
Well, I bet it's thicker than you think is my point.
Oh, yeah. Top. how could you imagine being a business that rejects 97% of all applicants or customers?
No, that's what I'm saying. They don't. I'm sure they don't.
So they've devised a test they feel gets them close to that.
Well, let's say, you know, Dan, not to use you necessarily example, because you just sent in this one thing, but I read one recently where somebody failed like 5, 6, 7, 8 of these things in a row and then was really mad about it and said, you know, the world is burning or is broken kind of thing. And there's also some interesting things there. I would say that by the time you failed 8 interviews, it might be you.
Ooh.
I hate to say that, but you know what I mean. Like, that's a lot to fail, unless they're like all the exact same job that you're applying for, kind of thing. But like, I don't know. I guess that feels a little rude. But at some point, the whole world isn't broken, and you got
to. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think at some point you have to kind of look in the mirror and say like, maybe I'm a total jerk at interviews or something. But like you have to. You know, I and then work on that and figure out why you need to get better or how you can get better at that. But in general, though, I feel like the hiring process is broken. And I don't know if it starts at that the HR department who like writes these like I need a jQuery ninja, you know, or I saw one that was like, I need a JavaScript expert, not jQuery. You know, it's like
I think that was Laura's point in the end at hers was that. Yes, the problem is mostly there, and it's the job descriptions that are broken more than
yeah. And then I think there's another end, like on the like if your company hires people with CS degrees, they do the interviews. Like, so now you have like a junior developer, 24-year-old kid who just got out of college, interviewing a you know. Grown man or woman for a position and then is like, well, I know how to fizzbuzz, so I should ask them if they know how to fizzbuzz. So it's kind of that self-selecting, like we test people based on what we know and we have that bias. Like we want to hire people like us because we think we're the greatest. So we're looking for people who do things the way we do and know the things we know. And I don't know, for better or for worse. I don't know. I guess that's why degrees exist, is for this sort of, you know, kind of, oh, we all have the same baseline of knowledge from an accredited.
Yeah, it's an attempt at a bar. A degree is but similar to a
Dan
bar.
Dan said he has a degree in web development or web.
And has a School of Hard Knocks degree in running his own stuff. Yeah. So, Dan, you're going to be fine. I'm sure you're okay. Speaking of things that are new and weird and complicated and hard and maybe not all those things. Maybe some people have no problems with this, but this is from the new school of learning stuff. We have one here from Lachlan
yep.
Haywood.
Lachlan Haywood. I can read it. In terms of speed of development and task runners like Gulp.js are the best thing to have ever happened to web development. My company's build process is quite solid. We use SAS for styles, Browserify for scripts, and a whole bunch of little steps to improve file size, minify, uglify, etc., depending on the needs for any given project. Gulp can kind of be limited. I've recently started thinking, started to think that moving to something more encapsulating like Webpack might provide the benefits for moving toward newer technologies in the future. Is it worth trying to keep squeezing steps into our current build process, or should we be looking at replacing the entire Gulp process with something more solid like Webpack? Ooh, where's my wow, hot drama there.
I think it's no wonder why this stuff is confusing to people, but it's certainly confusing to me. Not that I claim to be some master of build processes or anything, but I'm around this stuff a lot, I feel like. And it's still hard for me to wrap my head around all of this stuff all the time. So Lachlan started saying, I love Gulp. Gulp's amazing. Gulp's done all this stuff. And ends this thing saying, uh-oh, maybe we should get rid of Gulp and move to something more like Webpack. So now we're putting Gulp and Webpack at the same level of comparison when is that fair or not fair comes into play. Like, is Gulp this is Webpack just the new Gulp? I would think not. You know, like to compare those as apples to apples seems a little weird to me. What do you know? I should point out also that if you don't know anything about Webpack, I know a little about Webpack, and there's a very good overview of what Webpack is from, there's a fellow named Glenn Mattern who's started a new like YouTube channel kind of thing called Front End Center. And he's got a video called Webpack from First Principles that you can watch that I think he does an excellent job of explaining what Webpack does. So have you dove into Webpack?
Yeah, I have like one project that's using Webpack, and I'm not a fan. I'll go on record. It is fine. Okay. I mean, it's a whatever bundler and minifier, right? I mean, it can also do like code splitting, and you can make different files from one thing. Webpack has
overly complicated. What's the
what's
the one thing you don't like?
So Webpack has loaders, right? So loaders are like tasks you write in Gulp. So you just include this loader, like whatever, Babel loader or something, Babel ES2016 loader. And that'll ES2016-ify your code that you put into it. Am I right so far? Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And you have to do a little bit of configging, right? And
there is some configging, which is definitely one of the things people don't love.
It's kind of like this. It's kind of like an improved grunt from that perspective to me. We're taking this stuff, and then we're like, we write the config, and then the loader does it all automatically for us in some sort of step order. I like the gulp task thing where you kind of write out the task you want to do. So I create my own loaders, my style loader, my SAS loader, my pack and minify loader. You know, like you could create a task called whatever Babel loader in gulp, and it would do the same thing to some degree. Anyway, somebody's going to write in about that, but I don't know the benefit. Maybe there's a speed thing. Maybe it's how, you know, Gulp does kind of streams, you know, everything's kind of a stream and you can hit kind of a limit on that. But I'm not finding the limits of Gulp enough to where I was like, oh man, Webpack solves all my problems. You know, I actually hit a problem with Webpack that it could only kind of iterate on one file at a time. So I needed like two configs to do the client and the server build. And it was just like, oh man, like I don't have one Webpack. I have two Webpacks. And so this is, I don't know. This seems like an issue. And I don't know if you've been following like Noah Lawson and the whole, like the cost of small modules sort of drama, but it's basically like the way Webpack packs everything together is it builds out like a giant JSON object that you access, and that can be kind of expensive to do. There's another packer minifier called Rollupify. That's kind of
Rollup is similar too. So that's why this stuff is so weird to me. So let's say you're trying to write in this very like futuristic JavaScript way, not just using like spread operators and arrow functions and backtick strings or whatever, but you're also trying to use ES6 modules or whatever, right? So import React from React or whatever.
All that.
Yeah, sure. So like now if you need to, browsers don't understand that yet, like none of them. So you need to, there has to be a build step to turn that stuff into older school JavaScript that the browsers can do. But you're like, no problem. I was using that ES6 fancy stuff anyway. I'm already using a build step to down compile that stuff anyway. And I want to concatenate it and I want to compress it. So I'm like, I'm doing all this build step stuff anyway. Why not also start using modules? Mm-hmm. So that way I can write in partials and stuff, and I can think in partials like we've been doing in CSS with preprocessors for a while. It kind of seems like, and you know, through the glory of CMSs, we write HTML in small chunks too. It's like, it's just the way that this industry is moving. Let's write things in smaller, more modularized chunks because it works with our brains better. That's what Rollup is, I think is like what, like I'll read all your imports and stuff, and I'll go get that stuff, and I'll smash it all together in a kind of intelligent way. And but you don't really need Rollup if you use Webpack, because it automatically does that stuff. But I'm sure there's also Gulp tasks that can do it too. And that's what Browserify did also, kind of, I think. It turns them into require statements, and then...
Yeah, it all does it in like its own little different way. And that's fine. I think how...
But Gulp is like, it can not only do all that stuff and is fairly easy to configure, but it can do whatever also too, right? You can be like, oh, I'm going to rename a file, and I'm going to, when this task is done, I'm going to run this other one where it moves files around.
I could make
around.
Gulp tweet every time I compile. Like I feel sure. It's like a Node app like that you write, almost like a Express app or something. It's just, it's a very like basic API, and I like that. That said, here's what, like, the line I would draw is, if you're getting into React and all that stuff, a lot of React tutorials say use Webpack, and
just comes along for the ride.
It's like Trojan horses its way in. And you got, I think it's probably wise to kind of go the way of the culture, like, follow the culture and where that's going, because all the tutorials will be written for like...
Oh, yeah. I mean, since we're using some of the stuff at Copen, we've gone all in and even been like, no, we're going to use the quoting, the way they use quotes generally in React tutorials. We're going to add spaces the same way. We're going to do all our naming conventions the same way on how they do camel case for things. And like, we're going all in and just going holistically in on it, because things tend to work better. And we've had that same experience like with Rails and stuff too. Like, if you just do things the Rails way, your just life gets easier.
Well,
and we're just like, we learned that from there. So when we are in React land, we'll just do it how they
and it
do.
Seems like I feel like React, one of the things was like, oh, you can just write JavaScript and do it your own way. But conventions have kind of sprung up and kind of built up. And I think it's important when you jump into an ecosystem to embrace the conventions of that ecosystem. So I learn Webpack, roll it out on a project or hello world it or whatever. But I find the documentation is notoriously terrible on the Webpack website, and yet people still use it. I don't know.
It's almost a testament to Webpack when you say that. Like, the popularity of it is so extreme that even with bad docs, it's still popular.
But is that a little bit of a cult smell? Like, there is a cult afoot, and all of a sudden we're all going to be wearing the same shoes, and it's going to be bad news. I don't know.
I have a feeling like we didn't exactly nail this. Like, there's some things, there's some really interesting stuff that Webpack can do that nothing else can do that makes it compelling. Mm-hmm. I think the way that it kind of figures out what assets are all required from a big mess of things and turns it into sensicality and can deal with your other assets other than JavaScript. I know we think of Webpack and JavaScript together, but it does CSS stuff as well. It does images stuff as well. So
it's, yeah, I think it's like something to know and be aware of, but I don't know, I still find it kind of obtuse. And I feel like all the loaders and what they do and all that is just kind of still a mystery. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, you put your thing in there and it spits out the thing. And that's very Unix philosophy or whatever, but I need a little bit more information. And then like my ignorance about what loaders exist and why I'd want to use these loaders. I had to do a dedupe loader or something to like dedupe, you know, functions that got imported twice. And I'm just like, why would a packer not just dedupe by itself or what, you know? So anyway, that's my unofficial Webpack review.
Yeah, we have no advice for you.
Learn everything. You got infinite time and money. Go for it. Go.
There's an Estonian fellow here who writes in and says like this. It's spelled like rain, but it sounds like Ryan. So rain, perhaps? S writes in, what's the most accessible way for marking up an email address these days? Let's do some mouth HTML. So you have an anchor link. And the text of that anchor link says, like, email me or something, right? But the href to that anchor link is a mail to, you know? We've all seen this. Mail to chriscoyer@gmail.com. So if you're using that on an HTML website and people click on that link, what happens? Well, I don't know. I did it this morning just while I was playing around with this, and on my default machine, it opened up Apple Mail because I happen to be on a Mac, and I've never altered the default behavior of this. I don't use Apple Mail. I use Gmail, and I use it in a tab in my browser. I've just done it like that for a long time. I like it that way. I think Rain is saying it's weird because the way that that's marked up, you can't even see their email address, and it has that, you know, that negative thing where it's like if you click the thing, it's, you know. Usually I have like good browsers. I have like good super HTML sense, and if I sniff out that I think it's going to be a mail to link, you right click on it, and in Chrome it'll say copy email address, and I just grab it and that way, and then I move elsewhere. It does annoy me when I have failed that test and it opens mail and then mail's like, you haven't set up your mail server yet, you know, like tries to onboard me to mail every time I accidentally click on this. As I was Googling around a little bit, I noticed there's a 2002 Paul Irish article on the old Google developer blog that says that you can, you know, basically trick Chrome into this. And I think this works in Firefox as well. There is a kind of global JavaScript thing, you know, the navigator object in JavaScript, which has all kinds of weird esoteric jobs. It has this function called register protocol handler, and you can override what you want the mail to handler to do, and you can say, well, open my stuff in Gmail. So there's a way to override it. But now that's just – now I've said it, and I tested it today, and it works. Now that's great for me, but you know, that's a hardcore nerdy thing to do. I think Rain is asking more about, is that still cool to like, do you use mail to links, Dave?
I tend not to. I don't know if you remember the mid 2000s, but putting mail to email at gmail.com meant that your email address automatically went into somebody's spam machine, you know?
I see. It wasn't obfuscated enough.
So that was the quickest way to start getting spam, you know? So I don't see many mail links, you know, email addresses just floating out there too often. I would think just do the mail to if you're going to do it.
And you not worry about the UX of it too much.
Yeah, like however the UX fits. If you could, like, you could ARIA label or something if you don't like the text in there, you know, if email is not descriptive enough or whatever. But I would probably, like, whatever.
I usually like it when it's when the text of the anchor link is the email address, because then you're being very clear.
Yeah.
You know, like, it looks like a link, and it is, and it also looks like an email, like, address. It's like
email info at example.com or whatever. Like, email this actual address. I think that's, like, kind of the canonical way to do it. That's how I would do it if I was going to do it. I think forms have probably superseded, you know, just like clicking an email. I don't know why, but
you could just not have it be an anchor link at all if you're that worried about it. You know, you could just be like, well, it's an email address. People know what to do with these things. If you want to use it, copy and paste it.
Yeah. Just copy and paste it. So that would be my, I don't know. That would be my kind of workaround. We used to do a really, really weird, like, JavaScript obfuscator. Do you remember those days where you put it through a little app that Dan Benjamin
made?
I'm
sure I have an old article on it. Oh, yeah. And there's definitely ones that, like, that you would, like, use weird characters.
Eval,
you know, I think even GitHub. Oh, yeah. JavaScript is one way to do it. But just, like, using the HTML ASCII characters for alternate versions of it could work. Or, like, putting in non-breaking spaces was, you know, or just putting it in an image. There's probably, like, 50 ways back in the day. This is it's a totally nerd bait. Mm-hmm. How do I get my email address on there? Or wasn't there one where it would, like, reverse the – you'd type it out backwards and the CSS would flip it around?
Yeah. That's right. And unfortunately, I don't think there's, like, a way to make it easier for the user. You know, if you have mail to email at example.com, it's going to try to open what the OS is going to open, whatever it thinks it needs to open, you know.
Well, it's by the protocol handler in the browser itself. So if it supports a protocol handler, you can take control over it, but it has defaults. It actually makes me interested, and I've had this on my guest post thing a long time because I've always been interested in companies that take advantage of this, is having your own custom protocol. Mm-hmm. Like I remember when I bought, like, remember Panax Coda back in the day? They would send you like a really fancy email when you registered it, and there would be a URL in it that was coda:// whatever. And because you've installed the app Coda, when you clicked on that from your email, it would do something in the application Coda. You know, I was like, whoa, that's so cool. It's like a URL, but like a... with a weird special protocol that does something that it knows will work for you because you've already proved that you have this thing. Mail2 is a protocol. Mm-hmm. So you could invent Dave:// and have it do something special and cool.
There's Skype has it. Skype://
Skype. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Hey. Yeah. Well, all right. Hopefully that helps you, Ryan. It is sort of like a, I don't know. There's not a great way to do it, I guess. You're doing it the best way, sort of. So
here's a super timely one that a lot of people are going to start seeing. I know we talk about Chrome a lot. I'm sorry. We should talk about more things. But I don't know. I use Chrome a lot, and my browser statistics show that like 95% of people on CodePen use it too. Here's a thing. Chrome 52 just dropped not so long ago. If you write color:, RGBA, and put some RGB numbers in it, comma 0.5 at the end or whatever to give it 50% alpha transparency. Now, by default in the dev tools, it's going to show you a representation of that color as 8 alphanumerics as a hex code, which is called an alpha hex, which is only newly supported in Chrome 52 and may, I don't think anywhere else yet, although it's part of the color 4 spec, I think. It's an alternative way to list a color with alpha transparency, but not using like HSLA or RGBA. Like it's a hex code that supports it. And it looks really weird because it's so weird to see a hex code that's not either 3 or 6 long. These are either 8 or 4 long. Anyway, Matt Edwards writes in, I was just admiring this site, and the URL is boostedboards.com, and looking through the developer tools, I noticed that they were doing a gray crossed background on the left-hand side with sections of CSS, particularly with the hex code with an alpha, and it was B7, BB, you know, whatever, what has a bunch of stuff. Is this new? It seems to be supported in Chrome 52, but I can't find any more information about it. I was going to note, Matt, that the crossed section things isn't because of the alpha code. Like the cool cross stuff they're doing is because they were like translating some divs with rotations and stuff. But I think you know that. I think the colors of the background colors of them are alpha transparent via this property. I doubt very much that the developers of boostedboards.com wrote their backgrounds
in a 8-digit
with this
hex
notation.
Yeah.
This is just Chrome DevTools showing it to you in that way. And you can change DevTools to show you that in different formats. It's just for some reason they're defaulting to this, maybe to like show off or teach us something new. I don't know why the heck they're doing it, but it's just an alternative way to write numbers that have alpha transparency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it works in Edge. The site does. So it was kind of like, I was like, I don't know where this is being written. So it's something Chrome is translating, but that's kind of the future of colors. It is weird to me. Like I understand hex, like 0 to 255 can be represented by 2, you know, 0 to F, right? Like a 2-digit number pair, alphanumeric pair. But I don't understand the last digit. Like this one is B7BBBD33 is the alpha. And so like,
I think the alpha is at the beginning, not the end.
Oh.
I think it's B7. Isn't B7 the alpha and then the rest of it is the color?
Other way in my brain, but I don't know. Seems like you'd enhance into the alpha, but
well, it's one of the two because I don't think.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, and then the alpha you'd think the alpha would just be 01, 02, 03 or whatever, all the way up to, I don't know. I guess maybe they don't do it that way because what is 00, 100 or 0? So they would need three digits. So that's weird. Anyway, they don't do it that way. 50%, for example, is 80. 55% is 8C. 80% is CC. There's like a whole chart that maps the, and you can do any percentage from 1% to 100% with these special codes. And then they get added onto the, I think it's the front of the number. Anyway, oh, I did some testing and it does.
Because it's RGBA. So it's following that same thing.
I don't know why I had it in my head as the other era. I'm sure.
RRGGBBAA. But I don't know what is 33 though? Is that 33% or is that?
Well, we can look in the chart here. Let me.
Or
look
is that
it up.
Like 10% because it's only like
33 is 20% for some reason. And you're right, it is at the end. So let's just stop my.
So you can have 255 levels of opacity or alpha. So, oh, okay. All right, I'll get there.
And if it's four digits, doesn't that mean that, like, here's a code that works, FF07. Doesn't that mean it's FFFF0077? So 77 in this weird world is, oh, God, this is so
it's
hard.
It's going to be like, it's going to, I don't know. Is it going to?
I don't think 77 is a valid one. So maybe it doesn't.
What are the valid?
I think it triples the FFs and then zeros. It doesn't triple the N. So 07 is actually the alpha code.
What?
No, that's not right. Cause 07 doesn't appear to be valid unless it's like 2.5% or something. I don't know how this works. It's very weird. More importantly, I don't understand why this exists at all. Like, who cares? Who does this benefit?
I think clever people got together and said, ugh, typing is so difficult. Let's make a shorthand for it.
God.
I guess,
listen to the show. I'm sure there's people who have turned off the show. Like, these two guys, they're talking about something they don't have any business talking about.
Keep talking about colors they don't understand. So, anyway, it's adding alpha to your RGBs. Yay. We'll use it one day.
Roll to your hex.
Yeah, to your hex. Okay. Next.
Let's really get into a quagmire. So if you love us, you're going to love this, I'm sure. Madam Grachov writes,
if you like us stumbling through questions, you're going to love it. Yes, Madam Grachov writes in, please debate this article. And a link to 456 Berea Street, a classic blog for discussions, why I don't use CSS preprocessors. I found this article quite thoughtful. My two big incomes from using SAS and includes and variables. So like the two things I like are includes and variables. But looks like today we can solve that more simply just using something like post CSS or just in native CSS or post CSS. So,
well, that's kind of giving away something what's going on here a little bit. So Vadim is writing in saying, let's talk about Roger Johansson's, and like Dave said, been around forever, writes about accessibility and CSS forever. Very smart person in the world of CSS. In the article, it's September now, and this was written in March, but of this year, so it's new-ish. And the article is titled, Why I Don't Use CSS Preprocessors. And we're not going to read the whole thing, but you could very quickly because it's not all that long of an article. And he just says, listen, I've tried them, but it feels more like a solution, it's like a solution waiting for a problem kind of thing. And that the benefits of CSS preprocessors just aren't there for me. And then list some reasons why he doesn't like them. And I think we could probably go through each point because this is an interesting article, especially because I think the wave of preprocessors, it's a roller coaster like it ever was. You know, then when they came out, it was so popular even here on Shop Talk Show for us to discuss, should I use them? Should I not use them? What are the advantages of it? I gave conference talks about how awesome and useful I think that they are. And now, I think they're probably as popular as they've ever been. Mm-hmm. You know, like sometimes a band gets super popular and then the cool kids don't think they're cool anymore, but the band is still selling more albums than they ever have.
Smash Mouth.
We're at that.
Yes.
Yeah. we're at that point where I think people are starting to come back, like the cool kids are starting to come back down off preprocessors and be like, okay, maybe it's maybe they're not as cool as they once were, but their usage is probably still at an all-time high, I would feel like. And you might fit that description a little bit, Dave. You've mentioned on this show that you're less into them now than you ever
were. Yeah, I'm kind of like in a minimalism phase, just trying to only add complexity where I need to, if that makes sense. Like don't just start off on the preprocessor, only like graduate into it. Do I have enough CSS like that I need to split up into partials, or, you know, am I actually using variables? Not really.
Well, that addresses the very first point here. I don't feel, this is Roger now, I don't feel the problems of CSS preprocessors intend to solve are serious enough to warrant the cost, i.e., to me, the solution is worse than the problem.
See, and that's maybe fair. I think, it's what I like about, there's three things I like about CSS preprocessors, and it's variables, which are handy, but you have to go, you end up like copying the variable anyway, and then pasting it is same as like pasting a hex from a comment block, basically. And then you have, the nesting, like code nesting. I love that. That is like the reason I will probably use a preprocessor. I just like to nest my code. It lets me know when I've gotten too crazy, but you know, conversely, that kind of leads to really gnarly CSS and
we could probably go down the list, right? Because there's things that preprocess, there's only a handful of them really, right? It's like variables, nesting.
And partials. Partials is my last one. Just
partials includes mixins. There's not that many. That's about it. So partials is one. Okay. So what's your favorite feature? And it's nesting and partials.
Nesting and partials. Partials is so great just to like, this thing does one job and that's beautiful, you know, but could you also just put a bunch of comments and spatter out, you know, some fake lines and,
right.
But
I'm starting to, I used to think that partials was the most benefit that I got from them also. And now I'm starting to be more like, I don't know, was that just, that was like a weird, that's like a weird developer convenience that I'm starting to less.
Yeah, you get into like a naming things problem, and that's you can solve that, but it's also just kind of, oh shoot, what do I call this partial, and then what do I call the thing in the part? And then like, how do I nest these and organize these?
I think it's especially coming about from the fact that most sites these days are taking all the CSS from their entire site and they're smashing it into one giant CSS file and sending it out and saying, browser, cache this. I know that you don't have a problem reading this fairly large file and parsing it and finding the bits that are useful for this particular page. Starting to be gone are the days where we load a different CSS file for different areas of the site, trying to be more efficient with our page weight, because that's taking less advantage of browser caching and things like that. Partials were more useful when it was like, I don't know, here's different sections, and for the about page, I need this, 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 and this. For the cart page, I need this, 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 and this. For this page, I need this, this. People are gonna be like, screw that. I'm just going to smash it all into one big old CSS file. And when you're doing that, profit from partials is lower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're munging it all together anyway, but the one problem that CSS preprocessors solved was minifying. Like, it auto minified all your stuff. So now you're like the most performant you can be. But as we've kind of,
okay. Should we go there? Do you want to talk about?
No. Yeah. I mean, like we talked about, like, I mean, gzipping actually will get you way more gains, but you've stripped out the comments. That's probably nicer for the user or whatever. But, you know, there's I think a few more benefits, you know, CSS preprocessors can do for loops. I don't use for loops in my CSS. I don't know why I would, except for some like rando thing. What other, I mean, you have, yeah, that's it. I think, you know, also extends were very popular. Oh, CSS has extends. And it turns out like extends are kind of bad. They kind of just really bloat things. They like,
well, that one's related to Roger's next point a little bit. I want absolute control of my CSS, which means when I work on it, I want to see exactly what will be sent to the browser. And I think maybe that's kind of a subtle jab, but extends, and that extends is the reason that they got out of control is because people stopped being able to visualize what SAS was doing and making these crazy selectors and stuff. And, you know, so Roger's saying, if it means I have to see the same declarations a couple of times, so be it. If I need to look at vendor prefixes, so be it. That kind of thing. I want to see what the browser's going to see. Mm-hmm. To that, I would say, I feel like I can. I've been using preprocessors long enough that I'm pretty good, I think, in my mind, at seeing what these abstractions are going to do. And, you know, that just comes through experience, maybe?
Yeah, I mean...
And I don't want to look at vendor prefixes, so sorry. I want that.
Yeah, exactly. Vendor prefixes was a nice benefit. Like, just, hey, computer, you write these. I'm tired of writing these. So his next point, I don't want to learn and depend on a non-standard syntax to wrap my CSS in, making it require compilation before browsers can understand it. Neither do I want my colleagues to have to. So
non-standard syntax. So is SAS a non-standard syntax? Well, yeah, it's not CSS syntax, but I feel like the popularity of SAS and how seriously they took the syntax and making smart choices about it almost makes it a standard syntax.
I think a pseudo standard. I mean, anytime a bunch of people like kind of agree on a thing being good, I think that kind of comes into being a standard. I mean, it's interesting. Also, we spent like 20 minutes talking about Webpack, you know, which is sort of the same thing. It's a preprocessor for your JavaScript, you know, to make like your future JavaScript work in older browsers. And that's sort of what SAS did too, is like it made variables work in older browsers. And it's interesting.
Yeah, kind of, although that's tricky because I don't want to conflate the issue too much of that now variables are here in CSS and they're the same as what SAS variables. No. They're very, very much different things.
Very different.
One of them is just an abstraction of a value that you can use over and over, and one of them is kind of a runtime thing. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Okay. So I feel like there's a little bit of irony in this point because Roger goes on to say, and this is the twist in his article, is that like I don't like preprocessors, but I like post CSS. One called CSS Comb that sorts declarations in a certain way and fixes some styling issues, that inserts vendor prefixes. He's talking about a prefixer, I'm sure, that deals with fallbacks for custom properties and linting and stuff. So Roger isn't saying, I hate new things. In fact, he's almost more progressive in saying that I like these like things that I'm writing for myself. And I understand that, you know, using some kind of processing on CSS does have value. I just I have very specific things I'm looking for in value that aren't the same ones as like stock less or stock SAS has to offer mm-hmm. me. So I find, though, and this is, you know, like I write a product that supports post CSS, I've used post CSS. I'm not an anti-fan of it, but I find that, so, you know, the deal with post CSS is, remember, it doesn't do anything by itself. You have to add add-ons to post CSS to get it to do anything. And so every project is like a boutique picking of random post CSS things you can pick. And I think there's about a 50-50 shot that the thing that you pick in post CSS is a really weird non-standard syntax. It's just some syntax that they've just invented for themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's happened more and more to me to know that I can't... let me just back up and tell you a little story.
Okay, all right.
About,
I got time.
About how... Yeah, I got time. We want to offer post-CSS in more ways on CodePen, right? In a very popular way that we know, or at least I keep saying it's very popular. I don't know how popular it is, but it's even a way that post-CSS has said, hey, this is a way that you can use post-CSS. Run it as a post-processor. Run it after you've run SAS. And I always laughed at post-processor because I'm like, dude, it takes some CSS and it processes it and it spits out stuff, just like a preprocessor. It's a preprocessor, you know? And I think they kind of agree with that too. But then I've backed off and started more like calling it a post-processor because it's like, do all the stuff you're going to do to CSS first, then run it through post-CSS as the last step kind of thing. And I'm like, okay, you kind of can't do that because some of these post-CSS plugins, like cough, a lot of them cough, invent a syntax that is not going to go through SAS. Mm-hmm. Like there's like a weird, it's like, oh, I can do whatever I want in PostCSS. I'm just some random author of PostCSS. PostCSS makes it so easy to write plugins that I like. So here's like the min-max plugin that allows you to write a media query in a really nice syntastic way that's like when the page is lower than this thing and bigger than this, right? You can write a mathematical expression that uses both.
Okay.
Greater than and less than signs, that's going to fail in SAS. SAS is going to be like, nope, not doing that. So you can't post-process. You can't run SAS over it and then run post-CSS because it's going to fail the SAS part. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you got to run it first. And then it's like, but if you run it first, then there's some reverse problems that happen. And it's like, this is a very weird, complicated thing. And using them together is like not a panacea.
Mm-hmm.
It just isn't. So it seems weird to say, okay, I like the standard syntax of CSS. That's what I like, and I like post CSS. You know, because it's like if you're full on board on post CSS and just picking out random things, I mean, you could make the argument that I don't use those post CSS plugins. Well, fine, you're right then. But just to like blanketly say PostCSS is a better way, it's a more standardized CSS syntax, isn't true. The syntax of CSS ends up being a result of which boutique things you pick out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of like PostCSS isn't a thing. PostCSS is a collection of all the tiny weird things you want to do.
It makes it weirder than SAS does. There is no standard syntax for PostCSS. It makes everybody's CSS code base a random smattering of whatever plugins they picked out. It destandardizes the syntax.
Ooh, that's some hot drama.
I don't even care.
And I don't care.
Not really.
I think auto prefixer is still top notch. Let's give auto prefixer the
that's a high five.
So I have two stories. I'm gonna one up you. You told one story, I'll tell two. Anyway, okay, we got time. So I will use SAS when whatever I'm working in kind of has it already. Like I use Jekyll, and Jekyll has it kind of built in, so I get like all the advantages right there. I'm using it in a Rails app. Rails has it all built in. It's right there. I just use Rails and it spits out. But I generally like on the Jekyll projects, I have like a handle on it, but on my, what is this site? Day Trip, the Rails app, like I'm sending like 55K of CSS or something. And I'm just like, what is that? I have no, like, I'm pretty savvy and I don't know what all that is. So I have to, it's kind of on my to-do list to go through and be like, am I actually using all this? Do I have like redundancies? Is there, are two modules actually the same thing and I just coded it or copy pasted it twice? You know, what's going on? I have to reorganize everything. And that makes it harder to do because it's all split up into partials and stuff like that. So I guess I'll agree. If I have to agree, I'll agree with Roger that some of the pre-processing is causing problems. Like it's causing, there are, any like technological solution has like a byproduct that you probably don't want. But how much time have I saved overall? Probably tons, but
so maybe it's so hard.
Like ampersand colon hover. Oh, beautiful. Let me do that 100 times. Yeah. Ampersand colon hover comma ampersand colon focus. Gosh, that's my jam. I'll use that quite a bit. So you should too. Focus states.
I did want to mention this idea of performance. Like, so, okay, a CSS preprocessor can concatenate your files together, which is important because, of course, we don't want to be shipping a million CSS files, although that's a temporary problem, and we know that HTTP2 is going to change that kind of thing. But for now, concatenation is still a big deal. And minification is a big deal because it does strip comments, and there's some evidence that, I think Edge even said, hey, we're going to, it actually, if you minify your CSS, there's a slight performance benefit. It's a micro-optimization, but it's still there kind of thing. So we're saying, okay, CSS preprocess can do those things, and we know that they're important for performance, so we want to do them. That's cool. So because this is for the user, performance is for the user, it's a big deal and it's an easy win, so we might as well be doing it. So we're saying it's not optional. We have to concatenate and minify and gzip. Okay, let's say that's a pre, you know, we don't necessarily need a preprocessor to do that. That's just a build step thing. And if SAS does it, cool. If we don't want to use a preprocessor, we still need to do it through some other thing. Because it's for the user, it's important. It's a performance thing. So we're in a world in which a build step is required. We use them for lots of stuff. Like I know people might take issue with that a build step is absolutely required. But I think on most websites of significance, we're looking at some kind of build step, and they're great because they're full of developer conveniences and stuff. Like don't avoid learning about a build step kind of thing. So if we're saying we have to do this concatenation, minification, all these build steppy type things, the reason I think preprocessing got as big as it did in partial is because adding a CSS preprocessor to a build step is trivially easy. It's just like, oh, take this and run it through that as well. You know, you're already doing a build step, so you might as well preprocess also. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of part of the thing.
Anyway, all right. Yeah, I agree. Okay.
Are we bored of this one?
We should probably wrap it up here. I think we're hitting our time limit, but...
oh, you're right.
Sorry, everybody. Join us next week where we'll be on episode 234. Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. But we will continue our...
I think we're going to dress up for it.
Yeah, we're going to dress up, get fancy for it. And we'll continue our discussion on things we kind of only know a little bit about next on Chef Talk. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Really appreciate it. Be sure to star heart favorite this up in your podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. You can also tweet about it. We're at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Follow us for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. If you hate your t-shirt, head over to shoptalkshow.com/store, I believe it is, and get a brand new shirt. You'll look good in it. Darn it. And Chris, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Shoptalkshow.com.